Paula Cooper was 15 years old in 1985 when she and three other teenagers murdered 78-year-old Ruth Pelkey in an attempted robbery of Pelkey's Gary, Indiana home. Cooper was sentenced to death for her part in the killing. She became the youngest person ever to receive the death penalty in the U.S. In the years afterwards, something unexpected happened. Forgiveness toward Paula Cooper. It's chronicled in Alex Marr's new book, 70x7, A True Story of Murder and Mercy. Author Alex Marr joins us on The Spark today. Ms. Marr, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
And I want to mention that Alex Marr will be appearing at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg for an author's event next Tuesday, April 4th at 7 p.m. So let's start with the title of the book, 70x7. Where does that title come from?
That comes from a passage in the Gospel of Matthew that means a lot to one of the central characters in this story. And it's a moment in the Bible when the disciple Peter asks Jesus, "So what are you saying, that we need to forgive someone who harms us seven times?" And Jesus says, "No, not seven, 70x7. And I found that to be the perfect phrase to sum up the debate I'm wrestling with and the readers will wrestle with that's at the heart of this book. You know, what does it mean to forgive? And if we're wronged in such an extreme way through the loss of a loved one to violence, are we prepared to forgive? Is there room for mercy in our justice system? So these are some of the big questions in this book.
So even though the title is taken from a Bible verse, and there is a lot of people who are showing faith in this book. The book is not a religious book, is it?
No, this is a book for, you know, hopefully for someone of any kind of background. And I make note of the value systems of the different characters in the book because there's this larger question of, you know, when you find yourself in an extreme situation, what are your guiding principles for any of us? Is it the faith you were raised with? Is it the faith you converted into? Is it your belief in the letter of the law? You know, what is it that you lean on to determine the most moral, the most just reaction? How do you define justice? So you have someone like Bill who chose to forgive Paula Cooper. He was raised a devout conservative Baptist, but the people he grew up around, they wanted death for this young woman, and he did not. And so he had to kind of say, look, my version of my Christian faith says that we should forgive. So we're going to part ways on this. And then you have someone like Monica Foster, who ends up being on the appellate attorney team for Paula. And she was raised Catholic, but considered herself, she calls herself a flaming atheist, right? But she's someone who has fought for mercy on behalf of so many clients up for death over the years. And I asked her, you know, what motivates you in that situation, Monica? And she said, well, you know, I don't know, but someone has to fight for these people. So it's kind of fascinating. People of various backgrounds, you don't know how they'll respond when the stakes are this high and it's a life or death situation and they're asked, okay, so what is justice in this scenario? And I wanted to give a sense of that.
What did Paula Cooper do? Can you describe the crime itself?
So Paula and three other girls who went to Lew Wallace High School with her, they were all 14, 15, 16 years old. They decided to skip class one afternoon, and they were bored. They wanted money to, you know, get up to something. And one of them said, well, you know, there's an older woman who lives across the way. She's a Bible teacher. She lives alone. There's some nice things in her house. I've been over there. You should just knock on the door and ask her about Bible study lessons. And, you know, take this knife from the kitchen and you can scare her with it. And so three of those girls, they go and they knock on the door. They talk their way in. The situation escalates and Paula ends up striking Mrs. Pelkey over the head and ultimately stabbing her many times to death. They came away with nothing more than $10 and the keys to her Plymouth. And within a couple days, all four of the girls had been rounded up and arrested. Paula confessed right away. And the Lake County prosecutor who was extremely pro-death penalty, had a press conference, and he said, you know, I'm going to go for death for as many of these girls as I can. He eventually brought death penalty charges against two of them. And Paula was the one, because she was most actively involved. She was the one who received the death sentence in this case.
This was a horrific crime, as you describe in the book. What did the sentencing judge take into account when he sentenced Paula?
That's a good question. You know, her defense was a weak one. Her public defender did not knock this one out of the park. The judge was not given enough tools to kind of weigh both sides of this issue. What we call mitigating evidence, which is given more weight today than it would have been in the 80s, would have been stuff like the fact that she grew up in an abusive home. Her father was physically abusive. Her mother was an alcoholic. She was placed in emergency shelters, foster care, bounced around. You know, really, she and her sister were desperate to be allowed to leave that home and be placed somewhere else. And they kept being sent back. So, you know, really not enough of a sense of that traumatic background was given during her sentencing hearing. And it took time for that kind of information to get out there into the press. And that was ultimately part of the appellate team's strategy. Like, let's raise awareness of what this girl's background was like. It's going to influence the course of events somehow. So when she was eventually, like when her sentence was eventually commuted by the Indiana Supreme Court, in their decision, they did make note of the international attention and coverage that the case had gotten. It did have some kind of impact. But we didn't look as a culture. We didn't look into child abuse with the level of seriousness then that we do now.
I have to say that just calling this child abuse is almost an understatement. The way you describe the relationship between Paula and her mother in particular, I mean, her mother, I have to say, it comes off as a real villain in this book because she really just didn't show any kind of love or support or anything toward Paula. Now, that's not to say that the crime should be forgiven for that. But at the same time, I mean, it was just a horrific childhood that Paula had.
I think they're definitely, you know, and in speaking with Paula's older sister about this as well, I think there definitely were mental health issues on the table. You know, there were some mental health struggles with the mother and that were never addressed, never dealt with. And, you know, I call one of those early chapters the care of children, because their mother should have been caring for them. The community around that house should have been more aware of what was going on in that house. You know, I opened the book with a moment when Paula was 9 years old, and the mother takes her and her sister into the garage early one morning, shuts the garage door, puts them in the car, turns the ignition, because the mother has the idea that they're all going to end their lives that morning together. It doesn't play out that way, fortunately, but when the medics come and the fire department and whatnot, you know, they hospitalize the mother for a week. And then the family is reunited again as if nothing had happened. So there is a way in which the larger community and the system failed these kids. And the day when Paula appeared in court for her sentencing and was able to finally make a statement, she said something to the effect of, you know, where were you all? Where was everybody? This whole time I've been trying to get your attention. And it's not until this terrible thing happens, I did this terrible thing that I regret. Now everyone wants to know about me, you know, so there is this larger sense of when people are in trouble in your community, sometimes it adds up. And if you want to talk about making our community safe, let's think on the most basic fundamental level, you know, let's take care of each other and make sure people have access to resources so that you don't have young people who grow up traumatized and therefore potentially capable of violence.
The story changes when Ruth's grandson, who you mentioned, Bill Pelkey, he has a life-changing experience. Can you describe that?
Yes. You know, Bill is such an incredible character. his relationship ultimately with Paula, for me, is the spine of this whole book and truly drew me in. Bill had been drafted in the Vietnam War. He had two Purple Hearts as a result of his experiences over there. Came back, went to work at a local steel mill. He was a crane operator. He just showed up at work, worked all day, you know, went home. He was a really simple guy, wasn't into politics, wasn't making big public statements, kept to himself. But in the aftermath of this terrible murder, he really struggled with his grief for his grandmother. But also, it made him ask huge questions about his own life. And so he's called in for a late shift one night at the mill. He's up in his crane. No one else is there. It's just dead that night. And he's thinking about his life. His personal life has become a mess. His longtime girlfriend has left him. He's gone bankrupt for various reasons. He feels he has no direction or sense of purpose. And he has this moment where he thinks, you know, maybe the one person I won't disappoint this time is my grandmother. I think that I can do something for her. And I don't think she would want the death sentence for this girl. And he actually has a moment of picturing Paula Cooper on death row and how alone and how desperate she must feel. And he starts to cry, you know, when he thinks, I've got to do something. And when he comes down off that shift that evening, he knows he wants to reach out to this girl. And the next day he sits down and he writes a letter to the girl who killed his grandmother. And he mails it to the address on death row in Indianapolis and just waits to see what's going to happen. And eventually Paula does write back. And they start up a correspondence that ends up lasting for years, hundreds of letters that I was able to read to understand their relationship. And there was something about it, you know, once they started to trust each other, which took a second, there was a level of honesty I've never seen before. And you get to see also this teenager in such a desperate situation actually finding her own voice through these letters. And at some moments, she's even offering him advice with his problems. I mean, it's really quite remarkable. It's not the dynamic you would necessarily expect. And, you know, through making his forgiveness public, because he starts talking to the press about it, he writes a letter to the editor of the local paper. It gets his forgiveness gets picked up by the European press. It helps to keep this story alive and to complicate the debate around the death penalty there. You know, someone can say, well, I think this girl should be put to death for this terrible crime. And then someone else would bring up, well, did you hear, though, that the victim's family member, you know, one of them doesn't want this. One of them is saying that the grandmother wouldn't have wanted this girl to be executed. And that just adds a whole other layer to the debate that's highly personal and made people stop and take notice. So it was really an incredible instance of, you know, this story has multiple individuals in it who chose to take action in a way that was unexpected, that ran contrary to what was considered the norm or acceptable, and it made a difference.
Our guest today is Alex Marsh. He is the author of the new book, 70x7, A True Story of Murder and Mercy. And she'll be appearing at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg for an author's event next Tuesday, April 4th at 7 p.m. We were talking before the break, Alex, about Bill and Bill Pelkey and his forgiveness of Paula and how he was corresponding with us and how the two of them were writing letters to one another. That this grew into more than just two people writing letters. It became part of the death penalty debate. As you mentioned, the international press took notice. You know, you also show how Paula's case and some of its players connect up with the larger legal story of the death penalty, especially for juveniles in this country. What do you believe is important or powerful about this history of how teenagers are prosecuted in this country?
Well, so I don't know how many of your listeners are aware, but it wasn't until as recently as 2005 that the U.S. Supreme Court put an end to the death penalty for juveniles in this country. To me, that, you know, that's startlingly recent. And this is a history that was kept kind of secret in this country. A lot of people would say, well, but we never really executed kids. It might have been on the law books as an option, but we didn't do that. That's not true. You know, we've in this country, we've executed in excess of 300 kids for various crimes over the years. And we've sentenced to death more than 200 since as recently as the 1970s. This is something that's worth grappling with because it raises enormous questions about, as a culture, who we're saying is capable of rehabilitation, who is capable of getting a second chance. If we can't give a second chance to someone so young who's going to live for decades more, then aren't we suggesting that no one is capable of change? No one is capable of doing better. And that's something we really need to grapple with. It may not be constitutional anymore to execute a teenager, but we are the only country in the world right now that does sentence kids to die in prison. It's called life without parole, right? That is an option. So it's a huge part of an ongoing debate about what is just punishment. You know, the tough on crime approach that to justice that politicians love to run on, that still plays very well with voters today. And hopefully this story is going to inspire some people to look more closely at that kind of stance.
Paula was not a model inmate, the way you describe it in the book. Her death sentence was eventually set aside. What happened?
You're right that she wasn't a model inmate. She was fiery. You know, she entered the system. She was incarcerated so young. Think about the teenagers in your own life and how spicy they can be, you know. So this is someone who was on top of that, dealing with trauma, who was incarcerated for such a long time. But as time went by over the years, something eventually happened. She matured. She decided, you know what, I'm going to get out of here at some point, and I want to have a life. So she got her GED. She got her college degree. She was corresponding with hundreds of people around the country, around the world, people she'd never met who just wanted to know about her life because they'd read about her story. And when she got out, she got a job. She had a support network because so many people had worked on her case and been inspired by it, stepped up to help out. She actually ended up working in the Office of the Federal Public Defender in Indianapolis. Monica Foster was the public defender, still is today, and she had been on Paula's appellate team and said, you know what, why don't you try working as our receptionist and let's see how if we can make this work. She did great. Unfortunately, you know, the weight of so many years of incarceration, and I think also becoming mature enough that she really started to feel true remorse for what she'd done as a young person, it led to a depression, and she ultimately, a couple years after being released, took her own life, which is the other really great tragedy in this book. It's not the end of the book, but it is the end of Paula's life.
But even then, she hearkened back to her mother that she wanted a relationship with her mother.
Absolutely. You know, after decades of silence, her older sister, Rhonda, chose to talk to me and, you know, very generously and bravely. And we had a lot of conversations. And, you know, she shared with me that her sister had always had a fantasy of having this great family together. And it was a family that, you know, that was a fiction, you know, a figment of her imagination. When she was in prison, she would just think, oh, yeah, we'll all be reunited and it'll be me and my sister and my mom and we'll be like the Cosbys. We'll be, you know, it was a fantasy that kept her going. But the reality was that when she was released, you know, she was released back into a dysfunctional relationship with her mother, and her mother was ashamed of her and let her know it, and it certainly did not help. She was lucky to have the support that her older sister gave her, and that is a very important relationship in the book.
We only have a minute left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. So what do you want the reader to take away from the book?
I hope that this story lets the reader ask some bigger questions about, you know, what we think of as justice and the role that forgiveness might be able to play in our justice system, but also in our own lives. I know it's not an easy question and it doesn't have an easy answer, but that is the big question to grapple with at the heart of this book. And Bill and Paula's story is an emotional and challenging one that I hope is going to inspire people who dive into this book.
The book is 70x7, A True Story of Murder and Mercy. Alex Marr is the author. She'll be at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg for an author's event next Tuesday, April 4th at 7 p.m. Alex Marr, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to The Spark on WITF, your home for NPR and discovering all things local. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.